Thanks for downloading Profile. This week, Mark Coles tells the story of Michael Eavis.
Think of Glastonbury, and well, these aren't the sounds that usually spring to mind. But it is the music that's inspired the festival's founder, Michael Eavis, down the years. Descended from Methodist farmer preachers, now aged 80, he still goes to chapel every week. He disapproves of drugs, hardly ever drinks, prefers cows to celebrities, but just happens to love rock and roll. And 46 years ago, back in 1970, chanced on an idea to try to help pay off the debts of the Somerset family farm. Staging a music festival on his land.
It seems, I think, to many people, slightly incongruous to cite a festival here in the heart of very quiet, peaceful countryside.
Yeah, it's a super place for it. It's absolutely ideal. You know, it's away from the awful realities of life. It's a nice place.
You make it sound very romantic, but surely hard cash is really the object of the exercise.
Yeah, I think I'm just an average sort of fella, but obviously I've got an overdraft and I've got to try and clear it, you know.
It wasn't a great success at the start. Only a few hundred people gathered to drink free milk and watch a performance by Mark Bolan, who turned up in a velvet-covered car. But in the decades ever since, Glastonbury has morphed into the world's best-known festival, the largest greenfield performing arts event anywhere on the planet.
Glastonbury! You guys look great.
The list of those he's lured to Worthy Farm over the years reads like a who's who of rock and pop. The Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, U2, everyone from Amy Winehouse to Jay-Z. Mixing it all with political, religious and environmental concerns, the singer-songwriter Billy Bragg is adamant that Michael Eavis is unique among festival organisers.
I think nonconformist in the sort of traditional sense of that word, both in his sort of Quaker outlook and strong belief in peace and harmony. And I think that's what led him to start the festival. It's our festival, but it's his idea. And that's what's so important about it. He keeps it going. He's got the vision to keep it going.
He was born Athelstan Joseph Michael Eavis in October 1935, conceived during a moment of parental passion on Silbury Hill, he says. The eldest of five children growing up on the family farm in the Somerset village of Pilton. His mum, Sheila, was a headmistress. His dad, Joe, combined farming with preaching. This is Michael on Desert Island Discs back in 2008.
We went to chapel about two or three times a week as well. So the good old singing sessions at the chapel, you know, Methodist chapel. So he sang a lot of hymns around the piano as well. And my father was a very good singer. Mother used to play the piano. And so we did a lot of church stuff, a lot of chapel stuff, actually.
At nine, at his mother's bidding, he left the village to go to Wells Cathedral School. At 17, joining the British Merchant Navy. His plan, to spend 20 years at sea, returning with a pension big enough to help keep the family farm going. But it wasn't to be. Within 2 years, his father was dead from cancer, and Michael had to return home to run the farm himself, taking on extra jobs to try to supplement the farm's income. His son, Patrick.
He worked in the mines for a while in Radstock and he ran the farm. He's always had to hold down, you know, sort of numerous jobs, as I was saying, working in, you know, Somerset Brickworks. And he did that for years. I mean, he's always worked incredibly hard.
With three daughters from a short first marriage, Michael Eavis met his second wife, Jean, in a Glastonbury fish and chip shop queue in the mid-1960s, the pair of them coming up with the plan to stage a music festival themselves after seeing the Moody Blues play the nearby Bath Blues Festival.
Will you stay in a lover's story?
After Mark Bolan, David Bowie was booked the following year, Michael's son Patrick again.
One of my earliest memories is actually seeing quite a lot of naked people, you know, in 1970, 71, when it was mainly sort of hippies.
Enough to give you nightmares. If only you had a bed to sleep in, eh, Patrick?
My mother told me that I had to give up my bedroom for David Bowie in 1971, so I had to go and sleep somewhere else.
If it sounds glamorous, it wasn't, says Patrick. The festival disappeared for a few years, only reappearing in 1979, after his father gambled the farm as security against a £15,000 bank loan needed to pay the acts playing. The way he booked the bands was a tad unusual too.
who used to milk the cows with him at sort of 4 o'clock in the morning. He sort of dragged me out of bed, and then he'd be listening to the radio and, you know, choosing bands, and then he'd go and sort of ring them up, and 90% of the time they would say no. It was always a struggle financially. We never went on sort of holidays or, you know, anything like that. I mean, he always said the festival, you know, was our holiday basically every year.
It wasn't until 1981 that the festival proper took off, Michael Eavis assuming full control. And I was there. This is a recording I made back then as a young 18-year-old, one of 18,000 people who paid £8 for a weekend ticket to watch bands like Hawkwind and New Order performing on a stage made out of telegraph poles with a CND symbol attached. The year Michael Eavis first married music with politics, aligning the festival to the campaign for nuclear disarmament and donating £14,000 from ticket sales. His friend Mark Cann.
He was naturally drawn to CND. Emily had just been born. The world was looking a rather dangerous place in 1981, and he wanted to do something about it. And I think supporting CND in those early years of the 80s was his way of showing that concern.
But there were problems too. In the mid-80s and early 90s, the festival attracted large numbers of New Age travellers. The 1990 festival ended in violence. In 1994, the stage burnt down. The same year, Michael Eavis underwent his own battle with cancer. The Radio 1 DJ, Annie Nightingale, says she never saw it get to him.
You never ever see him with his head in his hands going, "What am I going to do? Backstage is a river." And, you know, they've had financial difficulties over the years as well. You wouldn't know that. He's not obviously going to go around telling everybody, but he seems to be able to keep the, if it's a facade, it's a very, very good one.
Then, in 1999, Michael's wife, Jean, died.
There was a 2-minute silence actually across the whole site. I could not believe that that whole site, all of those people, would have stayed still and silent for 2 minutes, would you? Nobody mucked around or anything. There was so much respect for Jean.
Bands performing that year, groups like Skunk Anansie, turned their sets into tributes. The band's lead singer, Skin.
I remember it being quite an emotional time because I think it was the first Glastonbury after his wife Jean died. Michael Eavis was there at the side of the stage and he watched the whole gig and we dedicated a song to him and he was very moved by that. And the whole prep was tinged with a touch of sadness, but it was a fantastic gig, a really amazing experience.
She having died, I was more determined to carry on because I didn't have a girlfriend or anything. I got loads of children, loads of grandchildren. Of course, all the kids are very keen on it. So it was like my new lady friend in a way.
But the following year, things got out of hand. An estimated 100,000 people breaking down fences and gate-crashing the event for free. Glastonbury Festival artist Joe Rush watched it happen. So did Michael Eavis, he says.
They built this corrugated iron fence. And, you know, the crowd outside decided to push it down. And, you know, they all started pushing. And then one moment the whole fence came down and people tore in. And he just laughed and laughed and laughed. And he said it was one of the most exciting things he'd ever seen. You know, they're breaking into his festival. But he thought that was brilliant.
Though he wasn't laughing when the local council decided to prosecute. By then, Mendip District Councillor Dick Skidmore had had enough.
Up until 2000, it was a living nightmare for those that were in and around the area. It became untenable, and the police and the licensing authority, which I sat on, realised that it was no longer viable the way it was being run.
The festival's licence was refused. Michael Eavis removed from direct management of the event, with an outside company brought in to oversee future festivals. Attendance is limited to 135,000.
Thank you, Michael Eavis. All the Eavises. Beautiful thing.
Since then, the festival seems to have prospered, though some say become more mainstream. These days, it's Michael's daughter Emily who does most of the booking of the bands. So what about his own musical taste, Michael's son Patrick?
He loves Elvis Presley, and Elvis Presley singing hymns. You know, he used to be his absolute favourite.
Oh, Lord, Michael.
Van Morrison, he really, you know, he used to always really, you know, play a lot, and Bob Dylan.
His musical taste is kind of quite strange.
Billy Bragg.
Last year, I had a conversation with him where he was really excited about the Moody Blues playing. and how great they were. And he was, I think he was going to get up and sing a song with them. And he was very, very excited about that. And he did actually try to convince me that the Moody Blues were better than the Beatles.
Then there's his dress sense, a tad informal, according to his friend Mark Cann, who was best man when Michael Leavis married for a third time in 2001.
The classic eccentricity that people would notice is his determination to wear shorts at any time. For his birthday, we decided to take he and Liz out for a meal at a very, very smart restaurant in the country. And Michael turned up for lunch. And the manager came up to me and just whispered in my ear, "Could I have a word with you, Mr. Cann? I noticed that your guest isn't wearing trousers." "Ah," I say, "is that a problem?" He said, "Well, we do have a dress code." And so I had to go back in and say, "Michael, sorry, but they're going to have to find you a pair of trousers to put on while we have lunch." And I said, "God, the same thing happened to me in the House of Lords."
Very much an outdoor type. He's a keen swimmer too, according to his son Patrick.
He strips off and goes for a swim at 7 o'clock every single morning without fail.
Every morning?
Yeah, every single morning.
Even in the winter?
Yeah, all year round.
Naked?
Yeah, completely naked. There you go. And he's very competitive too. We used to have a sort of yearly race up Glastonbury Tour, and you know, the winner got a pound, although he never paid it out because he won every year. So
it was his farm that won big last year, something he's very proud of. Despite the disruption from his annual music festival, the Royal Association of British Dairy Farmers voting his cows the best in the country. Who needs muse when you've got some top moos? Sorry, couldn't resist that one.
You know, now the farm's won a Gold Cup, you know, from the Royal Society for its, milk. And that was so important to him. He was saying it was better than all the, you know, all the festival awards, you know, to win that, you know, Gold Cup for the farm was, you know, beat everything else.
If pushed to choose, he told reporters, he'd always plump for the farm above the festival.
The farm always comes first. OK, that's the slogan around the farm. The farm always comes first. It's been 150 years.
For BBC presenter Lauren Laverne, that's what makes Michael Leavis and the Glastonbury Festival unique. The way it's rooted in tradition, literally. Even the oak tree first planted by his family when they bought Worthy Farm back in 1864 plays its part.
One of my favourite stories is about the tree that grows at the back of the pyramid stage. There's an oak tree that grows through it. And apparently when the pyramid stage was going to be located over it, the people who built it said to Michael, "Oh, we're going to need to chop down this tree." And he was like, "No, you can't chop down the tree. You have to build the stage around the tree." And I just think that's so beautiful and such a symbol of what the festival's about.
Michael Leavis has toyed with bowing out in 2020 when Glastonbury Festival finally turns 50, though Patrick doubts his dad will ever quit.
He would never retire. I mean, it's just not his thing. I mean, it's what he enjoys. It keeps him young. It keeps his mind active. So, no, I mean, that's basically his life. I mean, it has been his life and it will continue to be his life. I can't see him ever stopping and there's no way.
His friend, Mark Cann.
The festival is the ultimate expression, you know, for him of what he's about. You know, this festival is a celebration and he wants to celebrate the land. He wants to celebrate the environment. He, you know, his concern for the good causes, his concern for the political message of the festival. Those personal views, and I said at the beginning, you know, driven, you know, in part by his Methodist background, this festival, you know, represents him, and I think that's what keeps him going. You know, this festival without him would be a different beast.
Profile was presented by Mark Coles. The producer was me, Katie Inman. There'll be another Profile this time next week.